Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. I'm Matthew Darlitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy, and as always, here with my good mate and Managing Editor, Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
Howdy, Matt. Here we are once again in the wondrous joys of podcast land. And, we don't do it every time. I don't do it enough. Is a shout out to everybody listening. Good on you. It's really nice to have you here, whether you're on your commute or doing some jogging or just taking a bit of time. We really enjoy this opportunity to connect with you each week, and we hope you get as much out of it as we do when we're doing it.
Absolutely. And so today it's you and I, Richard.
The pressure's on.
Yeah. Because we've been having some conversations. We're writing a book together for Norton.
You have.
Unsurprisingly, it's about the science of psychotherapy.
Yeah, that, thank God for that, because otherwise it'd be a bit of a problem. But no, it's really good. I mean, Norton's have responded to the work we're doing, and they want us to put it into a book form. So we're each sort of looking at different chapters, and you got a bit interested in what I was interested in, my sort of task, which was around genetics and epigenetics and all those sorts of things, gene type.
That's right. That's right. So as you've known a lot about genetics and epigenetics before diving into doing these chapters for our book, but in our conversations that we've been having, it seems you've gone to a whole nother level of depth, and it's absolutely fascinating. So I thought we have to not only talk about this between you and me, but let our listeners in on what you're discovering.
Yeah, let's share, because we can't get all this stuff into the book. So it's good to do that. And of course, I started into this arena with my mentor, Ernest Rossi, who was talking about the implications of gene expression in human behavior and psychology and those various areas of therapy way back in the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, so prescient. Yeah. And I remember him saying to me, after we'd done a couple of years of my apprenticeship with him, he said, "You're quite good with the neuroscience, Richard, but have you thought about genetics?" In this sort of, over foreboding type of thing. And so off we went. I mean, his 2002 book, The Psychosocial Genomics, is talking about that subject and introducing that idea that we actually have genetic frameworks that are directly related to our psychology and our social experience. And it's so true. It's what I delivered a speech just yesterday to a group in India, talking about the qualia of our microbiology and even of our quantum, but we won't go into there today because that's the other thing that I need Toby to look at. Yeah. But so let's have a little look at that. Now, you're no stranger to this stuff yourself.
No, but I love some of the stories about the research that's been done, longitudinal studies of the epigenetic effects of trauma and what have you. And I've been reading on a surface level, but to tell you the truth, getting into it at any depth, it becomes awfully complex very quickly, doesn't it?
It does. The complexity, I mean, I thought the brain was complex, but genes just take you off on an exponential scale of it. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, so why I wanted to talk to you today about this is you've absorbed a lot of this complexity, but you've been able to talk to me in a way that sort of connects the dots and I can grasp some of the concepts without getting bogged down in a lot of jargon that I'm not familiar with. And so I thought we might be able to just touch on a few key aspects.
Okay.
And we'll bridge the gap between what we know about human behavior and some of the more complex theories and things you've been reading about with genetics.
Yeah, and how we're affected by them. So let's just start off with a couple of elements, two or three interesting bits of understanding of the nature of our genetic makeup and how we experience our genetic makeup. Remembering that all this knowledge is useless, or not useless, but it's not enormously useful in psychotherapy unless you're relating it to the human experience.
Yes.
So here's three words that are really important in the appreciation of any work with genetics: genotype, epigenotype and phenotype. So they're quite simple. Genotype is simply the type of gene structure you have. So that's just looking at the 302 billion letters of code and the order in which they're in and how they appear in the chromosomes. Now, that's our fixed framework. It's a largely fixed framework because you can have various changes to the actual DNA along the way. Let's not complicate it, but largely fixed framework. What people often call the blueprint of what we can create.
Now this was the big breakthrough we had a few years ago, where we were able to write out the entire genotype of the human genetic code.
That's right. The group that got together, and it was a massive group with millions of computers everywhere doing this thing, and they finally brought out the actual genetic code, the genotype of a human being.
Yeah.
Next one is the epigenotype, and epigenetics is simply the information written over the genotype. So, and it's just so sensible and logical. I mean, of course, if you're someone that is born in a particular environment and the environment changes, mm-hmm. well, then your genotype has to make some kinds of changes. Now, there are changes in which genes get expressed, but what our epigenotype does is it's the information that's added to the genotype that is learnt from experience that prepares ourselves for the possible and potentially possible, and in fact the probable possible future.
Okay.
Now that's an amazing thing to imagine, because we do this, you know, cognitively. We mm-hmm. learn something, we learn how to do something, and we remember that in order for us to be better prepared for the future. This happens way down in the very small area of molecules.
Right.
It's different memory to cognitive memory, but it is memory nonetheless.
Okay, this is the flexibility of the genotype, right?
That's right. Yep. So that enables us to have a genotype that can adjust and respond to changes in circumstances.
Okay, so we've got the structure, then we've got the flexibility. Now what's the third part?
Right, and the third one is the phenotype. Now, that is the word that we give for the emergent property, the emergent quality and quantity from that genotype and the epigenotype. So basically, that's the macro world. That's the you and me. That's mm-hmm. the how tall we are, what the color our eyes are, what sort of behavior traits we have, whether we have a healthy liver, whether we have a disposition towards this thing or that thing or the other thing. And we'll just drop in quickly back there in the genotype that you can have mutations in the genotype, which can occur there. But we'll just drop that in and leave that floating for the second. So the phenotype is what you see. So when you have a pair of twins, you can have identical twins, and you look at the phenotype, and it's very, very similar.
Yeah.
You can also, but then you look at those who are not identical twins, and they're very obviously a different phenotype. But because of epigenetics, what you will find, even with identical twins, that over time the phenotype begins to change. Hmm. Well, for example, one might respond unfavorably to a desire to eat, and so they might end up eating a diet that makes them obese, and so their phenotype will be different. Whereas the other one might respond to that eating pressure with more healthy foods and with more exercise and with more activity, depending on their experience, and they will have a different phenotype. So over periods of time, the epigenotype, even between identical twins, is what distinguishes them and gives them and creates their individual phenotypical expression.
Okay, so I'm seeing a three-layered sandwich here. Forgive me for the crudity of my example. So we've got the genotype, the structure at the bottom, which is the foundation. We've got the epigenotype, which is the flexibility that the genotype has. And then we have actually what you see, the manifestation of the actual person, the phenotype.
Yeah, it's the ingredients. Then it's the way you put the ingredients together, the mm-hmm. epigenotype. And then the phenotype is the way it tastes.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay.
Now, as we move through that aspect, we go, okay, so you epigenetics. There's some people out there listening will go, oh, yeah, I've, you know, I've done the study of this. I get it. But just a quick reminder. Is that a good point? Just a quick reminder of the technicalities of epigenetic changes?
Absolutely.
Okay. So we've got kind of two types of principal epigenetic changes. There's all kinds of complexity in when you have this incredible molecular microbiological world going on. But the two principal ones is we talk about a thing called a histone and mm-hmm. histone tails.
Yep.
And we also talk about methylation of the DNA itself.
Yep.
So let's talk about histones first. This is really interesting. And so you know, our microbiology is so curious. It says it's got this huge bloody long thing, this DNA, even though it's a chromosome divided up into 23 pairs, so 46 different chromosomes. But actually, some of these DNA chains are anywhere up to a meter in right. length.
Yep.
And you imagine that there's 23 of those all crammed into this cell. How on earth do they do that in this tiny cell? Mm-hmm. So there's these things called histones, which yep. are, there's eight of them. Mm-hmm. They come together and they create, they draw themselves together into a sort of a group, and they're positively charged.
Okay.
Now, DNA, the phosphate ring, ribbon around that holds the DNA together, is negatively charged.
Right.
So guess what positively charged and negatively charged things do? They draw each other.
Mm.
And so the DNA wraps itself very conveniently, only twice, not quite twice, around the histones, around this histone group.
Yep.
And it forms what's called a nucleosome.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And this nucleosome, so then your DNA starts to look like beads on a string. Now, what we usually see when we see people talking about chromosomes, we see this sort of little X thing. Yep. In the middle. That's actually only occurs for a very small period of time in what we call metaphase, which mm-hmm. is just before division. So right. that's actually where you have a reproduced copy ready for being reproduced. Mostly it's just this wild stringy stuff that gathers itself in different areas around the nucleus. With the histone and the DNA, they have then the capacity to be drawn closer together
mm-hmm.
if the ionic charge between them increases, or to loosen up if the ionic charge between them evens out. And okay. that's exactly the way the epigenetic change occurs on this histone level. And when it draws it in and squeezes it and tightly binds it to the histones, then it's hard for the ribosomes and the ribonucleases that do the transcription to get at the what we call the promoter sites. So it can't mm-hmm. get there. So it's done simply by tightening and squeezing it and squeezing them out.
So could we say this is a way of kind of like hiding a switch so the switch can't be turned on?
It's absolutely as simple as that. And that's exactly yep. what we do. It makes it so that the molecules that come in and go, oh, hello, this gene needs to be expressed. Actually, what they do is they go, oh, well, we're not expressing that one. And they just wander around looking for the available switches.
Okay.
Let's not go into the additional complexity of when things become as available as you think they are, but there's a greater complexity there as well. So it's not like everything that's looser on the histones will be expressed. But fundamentally, so that's one of the things. So you loosen up the bonds, the binding between the DNA mm-hmm. and the histones, principally with acetylation, as we yep. call it, because acetyl are negatively charged.
Yep.
They attach to these little tails that are hanging off, that kind of that hang off the histones and hold onto the DNA.
Mm.
And then that means that loosens up and there's no real attraction, and eventually it loosens up. And when there's gene expression, actually these histones can break away for the period of time of transcription and then come back again. So that's all kinds of fascinating. There's also methylation, there's phosphorylation, and there's ubiquitination. So there's a whole bunch of things go on, but that acetylation is one of the most important things that you'll hear about in relation to epigenetic changes on the histone, the nucleosome level.
Okay. I think I can remember it easily. If I think about the histone as kind of like a ball, in which the strands of DNA wrap around, and the tighter it's wrapped, the less likelihood there is of any changes happening within that part of the sequence.
That's right. Any switches being on. So all the switches are turned off by hiding them.
That's right. And if they're not hidden, then they're more easily altered.
And they're more likely to be expressed.
So that's histones. What else have we got?
Now, the other one we can do is we actually can affect the switches. Mm-hmm. So in simple terms, they're called promoter regions. And so they're actually on the DNA. Mm-hmm. So now, instead of looking at the switches being hidden, they're actually being blocked.
Right.
And blocking is done by methyl groups. Mm-hmm. So we have methylation. So you can have methylation of the histones, but you have methylation occurring. Now, there's a particular region, there's a particular way in which this methylation is triggered. And for those that know, just to let you know, it's the CpG repetitions. So what the hell's that? Don't worry about it. It's very interesting. The cytosine potassium phosphate things, repetitions. So you get these CpG repetitions, and methyl comes along and goes, oh, this is not good. We'll attach to the promoter region. Mm-hmm. And then when the ribonuclease comes along to do the transcription process, remember we start with transcription, which then creates the mRNA, which then goes to the outside of the cell when we have translation, which is mm-hmm. the different thing. So it's all happening inside the cell.
Yep.
And it just passes by, it doesn't work, it doesn't happen, and so it doesn't happen.
Right.
So there's two ways in which the gene... whether it's the protein-coding gene, and it also this occurs in the non-protein-coding genes, because only 1-2% of our genetic structure is for protein-coding genes.
Wow, that is amazing, isn't it? Only 1-2%.
Yep.
And yet it makes such a huge difference.
Oh, yeah. Well, all the other stuff, there is a certain amount of the other, they used to call it junk DNA.
Right.
But actually what it is all the other DNA all over the place are all the things that operate and enable the DNA to function, mm-hmm. which is really fascinating. So, producing, starting molecules and stopping molecules and continuing molecules and interfering molecules and bits of RNA that go in. So there's lots and lots that go on other than our immediate, than those things that are needed for protein construction. And we only have about 20,000 protein-coding genes.
Hmm, okay.
Now, interestingly, the Caenorhabditis elegans, which is a little roundworm, which is wonderful for research because it's kind of a bit small and hollow, and each gene kind of only does one thing, so it's really good to study.
Right.
It has about 20,000 genes.
Wow, for such a simple thing.
Yeah. So what it is with human beings is we do complicated things. We do dances and plays and games and multiple activities with our simple genes. So a single gene can be arranged in different ways. That's mm-hmm. let's not go into that. Some people will immediately go introns and exons. They'll know what I'm talking about. They can be done in multiple gene combinations to produce a combination message for the protein construction. So we produce many, many more changes and variations in the protein structures, but even the proteins, there's not a lot of them.
Yeah.
Now, I've forgotten the number off the top of my head, but it's not many. The amino acids, we only have about 20 or so amino acids, which are the building blocks of the proteins. Mm. But when you think of an amino acid of a protein string, 20 something to the power of 20, it's almost unlimited the number of variations that we can create.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, Richard, I don't want to lose people in this conversation. So we've talked about histones and promoter regions, ways of regulating this flexibility.
Yes.
Of our DNA. Now, are we able to make the leap from this level to what happens in terms of our experience, in terms of trauma, as to how that affects us at this molecular level?
Well, let me describe a bit of research which utilize a bit of research which has become quite famous, which is to do with rat pups.
Okay.
And licking and grooming mothers. Mm. But I want to start from the outside in. So I want to, as you're suggesting, let's look at the human experience.
Yep.
So Moshe Ziff and Meany, what's his name? Meany and a few others, mm-hmm. looked at, they were given the opportunity to investigate the autopsy results and the blood tests and the genetic assays of people who had suicided.
Yeah,
I think in America somewhere, in New York or somewhere. They were looking for epigenetic markers to see if there was something that could give them some insight into what disposed some people towards suicide and others not suicide. Mm-hmm. And what they found was a particular marker, which I'll describe in a minute, which was very similar, it was exactly the same as the marker that occurred in these little rat pups. What they did was they went then and looked at the history, the life history of those that they could, mm-hmm. and they found that all of the people that had this epigenetic overlay, this epigenetic marker mm-hmm. on their DNA had had a child trauma, had had some kind of a confused attachment, so very dangerous parents in attachment, or some childhood trauma that made them, and then they look at their lifestyle, made them hyper-reactive, hypersensitive, prone to depression and anxiety, more prone to not managing difficulties as they went through life, and eventually, sadly, they a lot of these people became totally overwhelmed, and life was no longer worth living for them, and they suicided. And they just went, wow, this is just like those rat pups.
Right.
Now, what happened in the rat pups was that if they had a good mother, a good mother, so mm-hmm. this is also concerned with our attachment work as well. If they had a good mother, now a good mother licks and grooms the babies, which is very healthy for them, and she tends to arch her back so mm-hmm. that her teats become available for feeding. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool. So these little rat pups, they come out, they get born, they wiggle around, they find mum because she's arching her back and sort of pushing herself towards them and making it available. Happy, 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 all good. No epigenetic change to this particular marker. Mm-hmm. The other rat pups come out and they have not such a good mother. In fact, they kind of called her the bad mother. And she had no inclination to arch her back. We don't know about her history because, unfortunately, they don't talk.
Right.
So she wouldn't arch her back and she wouldn't lick and groom them. And mm-hmm. so these poor little fellas had to be hyper-reactive. They needed to be hyper-centered. They needed to not settle down and feel comfortable until they had found food. Mm. So what they found was the glucocorticoid receptor gene in the hippocampus mm-hmm. had an epigenetic marker, methylation. It might have had an acetylation as well, but it's an epigenetic thing that turned off and so reduced the production of glucocorticoid receptors in the hippocampus.
Okay.
Wow. Why is that?
Mm. And this is an active process that was left alone with the good mother.
Yep.
But with the bad mother, the epigenetic...
Yep, that's right. It was added, the epigenetic was added to these neglected children, neglected babies, in order to help them survive. So it was very good. It did make them more stressed and more anxious, less resilient, but they certainly didn't get halfway towards mum and go, oh, I'm fine, and relax, because they would die. Now, here's the interesting thing. That what we have is we have a stress cycle. We have a system. So fundamentally, you get a stress, your amygdala and some areas of the limbic area fire up. That generates the HPA axis, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, which generates adrenaline, which activates the body into moving to take some action to resolve the stress. Now, what happens when things are going normally and the stress is resolved is that the cortisols, or the glucocorticoids is the technical term, goes back up through the system, back up into the brain, and is picked up by receptors in the hippocampus that says, oh, okay, we've got a whole bunch of cortisol going on here, this is cool, which then sends a message down through the limbic system back to the hypothalamus to say, you can stop agitating the HPA axis, we're on a roll, we're okay. And in fact, if it gets, when it gets certain levels, it can say, you can actually stop producing it at all now, just we're okay, which is what happened with the good mother rat pups. They would have this agitation, they would arrive at the teat, they're drinking the food, they're sustained, they're getting oxytocin, they're all happy, and everything's fine. Now, the little rat pups needed to find the teat. So when the corticoids came back up to the hippocampus, they weren't received, the receptors weren't there to say there's lots going. The receptors were saying there's not enough, which kept the HPA axis going, which agitated them more, which kept them agitated until such time as they arrived at the mother, and they eventually would calm down, but it took much longer.
Right.
Now, here's the other thing, which is really cool, and this is the essence of epigenetics. When they took a deprived, agitated, hyper-reactive rat pup and put it with the good mother within a reasonable amount of time, remembering that you can change your mind far quickly than you can re-describe, you know, re-remember in your genetics. The genetics is a lot less trusting about just an idea. It takes a while. But over a period of time, that epigenetic barrier to the production of glucocorticoid receptors disappeared.
Wonderful. So this is a very flexible system that if in circumstances, environmental situations that are not optimal, our epigenetics switches will turn on or off to try and deal with that stressful situation. But then you're saying, then if we come into an environment which is conducive, these things can be reversed.
That's right.
Right.
And this is why in therapy, one of the things that we've got to be very careful of is re-traumatizing our clients. So it is likely that a client who comes in who's had trauma and is anxious and is hyper-responsive will have this epigenetic marker in their glucocorticoid receptors in the hippocampus. Now, of course, you don't know exactly because there's a whole bunch of other things, but in principle, let's assume that they've got that receptor. They come in to you for therapy, and they begin to talk about their problem, and then they internalize it and they re-traumatize, then not only do you get memory reconsolidation, which we've talked about umpteen gazillion times, of the fact that we're in trouble, you get epigenetic reconfirmation of the fact that you're in trouble. And so you maintain this hyper-reactive framework.
Right, right. Now, we're talking about a very specific response where the hypothalamus, the HPA axis thermostat, for want of a better word, becomes dysfunctional. Like, well, the change seems to be functional in the moment because we want to keep the HPA axis going because we need to be fed or have protection or whatever. And then you're saying once we're in an environment where all of those things are satisfied, eventually these things will reset and we can have a HPA axis with a functioning thermostat.
Yes.
Now, I'm wondering, are there other things that can go wrong when in terms of epigenetics that we would deal with as therapists?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so because what I'm thinking is looking at the ways in which we respond to the different elements, because the thing is that glucocorticoid receptor gene is just one of the self-regulating processes that makes us hyperactive. We can then look at dietary issues that come in that cause us great problems. One of the issues we have that causes us to move more towards obesity, which leads us more towards the inflammatory processes, which can cause so many disturbances and manifest as depressions and anxieties and even more disturbing things as PANDAS, as you've talked about.
Yeah.
And that occurs in the nature of the receptors on the cells that seek to receive nutrients by sugar and lead us to have insulin resistance.
Right.
So remembering that everything that happens to us, everything that is open or closed or changes or grows, is due to the proteins that we produce in relation to gene expression.
Right, yeah.
If you have the gene expression, you will get the protein. If you don't have the gene expression, you won't have the protein. And this is the nature and the importance of epigenetics.
And I think it's important to remember, so when we talk about changes that are changing maybe fundamental things about metabolism, you know, we're very focused on what we would consider downstream to that, our higher thinking, you know, emotional responses. And yet there is some very fundamental things upstream when it comes to basic physiological processes that are changed, but thankfully can also change back.
Can also change back, or we can affect them. And I'll just move briefly now, because we talked about this importance of methyl groups, this methylation.
Yes. Sure.
And this methyl stuff is like really important. And so this is this allusion I made before, alluded to mutations.
Okay.
That you have not only epigenetic interferences to some of these processes, but you can have mutations. Now, they occur during the, when we produce the gamete, meiosis, but they also can occur just in bad separations of cells. That's where we get cancers from, where we screw up the mitosis process. But this methylation process is terribly important. Now, it's kind of complicated, so we won't go into the details of it, because it's also, it's always this thing of methyl tetrahydro folate, and then you get methylene tetrahydrofolate, then you get methylene tetrahydrate folate reductase, and then you get methanion synthesis. So we won't go all that, because nuts.
I had a chart on my wall once with all of the methylation thing. It was like literally rocket science, and it was so let's not go there.
Just call them Bob and Barry. It's like the neuroscience. But the importance is we have a cycle, we have a system that produces these methyl groups. Now, the methyl groups are produced from foods that we eat that contain methyl groups.
Yep.
And the one that we're most familiar with, we've heard about, is folate. Mm-hmm. That one is one of the principal ones. Then you also have the activators of the process, which is B12.
Yep.
And B2 and B6. Folate is actually B9.
Okay.
So this is where diet is terribly important to this methylizing process. And so it goes through, and this it would be so much easier if you just ate some spinach and then it just turned into methyl groups and off it went, because it activates some our COMT and our MAO enzymes, which all do things in the synaptic cleft with breaking up various neurotransmitters. It goes off into another cycle and another cycle that's to do with, of course, epigenetics. It's to do, we need methyl groups in order to do DNA repair. We need methyl groups on so many levels. Now, here's the thing that's interesting for us as therapists on the macro level.
Yep.
That if the system gets mucked up, and this MTHFR, this methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase enzyme, if it has a particular, and there are a few different mutations where it doesn't operate, doesn't function correctly, what you do is you don't get the methylation process occurring, and a thing called homocysteine builds up in the system.
Yep.
Because what it is homocysteine comes along, a methyl group is added to it, it becomes methionine, which then donates the methyl group. So they're doing this cycle. And if you're not getting the methyl groups coming in, you get this buildup of homocysteine. And if anybody's looked at their blood tests,
yep,
homocysteine levels are one of the levels that we look for. In mental health, along with CRP, which is your C-reactive protein, looking at inflammation, which is terribly important for an infection which may be affecting mental processes.
Yeah.
So if you've got if your client has come because they've got problems, they've been to their doctor, they're worried about things, they've had a blood test, get them to bring it in and see if they've done the homocysteine. And if it's elevated, then what that tells you is that they're having a limited amount of methylation, which is affecting their synapses, which is affecting their epigenetic processes, which is affecting their DNA. And we go on, but it's those are the principal areas that affect mental health and our ability to manage.
Yeah.
So what you do is you go back and you eat things that are kind of useful. And it's not hard. You eat things like cooked spinach, red beans. You've got fortified breads. We've been adding folate to breads for a long time. Pawpaw, mushrooms, asparagus. I love it. This is one of my favorites. Peas.
Right.
So cooked peas. I love them. They say cooked peas because that breaks things down a little bit. So there's lots of the guava, for goodness sake, is really useful. But it's so interesting what the methyls do. Here's a couple of things. Methyl groups, so homocysteine will leak into your blood vessels and create problems with your cardiovascular issues. As I was saying, it's reflective and important in mental health because of the way it improves production and disintegration or reduction of the neurotransmitters in the synaptic cleft. Histamine, when you get an allergy, histamine rises up, a methyl group attaches to the histamine and that nullifies it, and it's that histamine is then removed from your system. If you don't have enough methyl groups being produced in your system, that is much more difficult for you to get rid of excessive activity of histamines.
Now, this is something that this is something I'm personally familiar with because I do have a methylation issue.
Yeah,
and histamine is a big problem for me. Mm. So that means I have to be careful.
Yeah.
So I'm sensitive to things that might elevate histamine.
And here is the message that you and I were sharing the other day, saying, okay, I just eat these foods, or I have some B12, or I eat more folate. Mm. And the thing is, maybe not.
That's right.
Because maybe you have the MTHFR mutation, which is causing you problem in the system, in the processing system. And what we need in order for the MTHFR reductase to work effectively are the stimulators, which is B2, B12, and those areas in the folate. So nothing is translating, nothing is transferring and activating these things into the methyl form.
Yeah.
So when you're taking your B12 or your folate, what you need to do is you need to take the active form.
That's right.
So methyl B12 and methyl folate.
Yes, that's right. So I have a activated B complex of vitamins.
Because that's a separate, so there's a second process, there's a second system that goes on, which is called the betaine, which is based on these activated B things. So our body doesn't even just do this one way, it does it two ways, sort of just in case. But of course, sadly, if you're just sort of chomping down on, fried fast foods, you're going to just, it's not good. It's not good. So
this is where knowledge is power, right? Yeah. If we understand some of these systems and what's going on, we can avoid maybe years of, not understanding what's going on in our body or feeling depressed or anxious or, the different manifestations that can happen with maybe a methylation cycle that's not working so well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if we can, get the right information and understand, okay, so maybe part of my methylation cycle isn't working so well, I've got a histamine issue and I can address that, suddenly everything comes, there's clarity, things come into focus.
And it could be this mentalizing this positive mentalizing as you're eating the food, certainly as you're taking the tablets of things, but this is in, these things are in foods, in the foods we were describing,
yeah,
that you're eating. So it's, oh, I don't like spinach. But it's like, hey, Mr. methylation process, I'm getting you. And yes, Mr. Mutation, you can't get me.
I think also just knowing, right? So it gives us a sense. So one of our mental processes that we need is a sense of control. And if we have clarity about something's going on in a body system of ours, we have clarity, we have a sense of control, and that reduces anxiety. You know, and mentally from top down, we are going to do a whole lot better just by knowing. You know, we may not follow the protocol perfectly in taking whatever we need to take. We might stuff up with our diet every now and then, but we know what's going on. So when we feel the ill effects, you know, and we have a knowledge of what's going on.
And remember, as Lisa Kozlina tells us in the neural processes, good enough is all our body needs. But there was a perfect in what you were saying, because it reminded me of one of the questions with the group the other day. And he said, can I control this methylation process so I can control my emotions?
Right.
And I thought, yeah, I get it. Control is the word we love. We love as human beings to be in control, as if, you know, we still think that our will is stronger than the self-organizing, you know, billions of things going on. And I thought, good question, but just wrong language. And I said, no, what you can do is you can contribute to the better functioning of your natural processes.
Yeah, yeah.
And in doing so, you can manifest in yourself emotions that will reflect that positive contribution. But can you control your genes? Not really.
No,
because again, you might shove yourself full of spinach, but you need the knowledge. You need is, oh no, I'm not needing ordinary folates. I actually need activated folates.
That's right. So not knowledge and clarity that knowledge brings.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Richard, I'm just aware of the time. We've been yabbering on for a while now.
Yeah, I know. I think people's brains might have melted. In a joyful way.
Yes, but a fascinating topic. And look, as we continue to write, you know, maybe we should check in every now and then and just, you know, talk about some of these topics, because they're very fascinating and they do have relevance for, you know, what we're doing as therapists. So,
yeah. And next time you have to promise it's your one, because that was a lot of talking from me. So I want to hear where you're going. And so for everybody listening, this is the stuff that's coming out in this book sometime next year. Mm. And wow, it's so fascinating. And we're just scratching around on the surface, but we're scratching around the fascination of knowledge and the empowerment that it gives us to be able to act in a contributing, or to contribute in a functional way.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for staying with you. If you've stayed with us for this long, I do really thank you.
Oh, wow. It's been that long. Sorry, folks.
thanks for tuning in to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. Thanks, Richard, for sharing your knowledge. And we'll catch you guys next time.
Okay. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.